Welcome to Stories of Stories. I'm your host, Mike Chin. In each edition of this podcast, I explore the stories behind a specific creative project, process, or experience. You've tuned in for the very first live recorded edition of Stories of Stories. Typically, I discuss the story behind the creation of a specific creative piece or a project that's already been published and is out in the world. For this episode, I'm giving you the audio of a lecture and reading I gave at Georgia Gwinnett College as part of their Readings, Writings, and All That Jazz series, an annual set event for which faculty members speak about their research or their pursuits outside of teaching and their creative projects. So I delivered a lecture entitled Pro Wrestling, Postmodernism, Poetry, and Prose. And I read a collection of work related to wrestling, some poems and excerpts from a short story and from an essay. Some of the work has been previously published, and some of it's still in various stages of revision, or I'm getting ready to send it out. I wove in this concept of postmodernism with the work, and part of that is because I think it's at the heart of a lot of the creative work I do around wrestling, and of course, some of it was in order to catch the ear of the more academic audience, to make sure they didn't think I was coming from completely out of left field here and giving a lecture about wrestling. So that's part of the meta layer of this presentation, because in general, I feel that part of being an adult pro wrestling fan is justifying yourself and trying to make sure people know you're not an idiot, and that's part of what I address in the lecture as well. But in any event, that's some of where the discussion around postmodernism comes from. In addition, I'll use that as an excuse for some of the relatively highfalutin vocabulary and tone that I get into during the question and answer portion of this recording. So the audio on this, I think it's quite reasonable, but maybe a little bit less clean than what you'll ordinarily hear on this podcast. There's a Q&A session at the end that I alluded to before, and I know it's nearly impossible to hear the questions being asked on the recording, and I didn't always do the best job of reiterating them. So that part may be more difficult to follow, although I think you'll get the gist of what was asked based on my responses to it. And ended up, you know, getting into some answers I thought were, you know, sort of interesting for this particular conversation, so I decided to keep that in with the talk. So in any event, this is Pro Wrestling, Postmodernism, Poetry, and Prose, recorded at Georgia Gwinnett College on October 26, 2017.
All right, hello everyone. Thank you for being here. You thought you were in for a standard reading, but we're going to mix up the topic a little bit here today. So, my name is Mike Chin. I teach composition here at GGC and am a creative writer in my own life outside of that. And I'm also a professional wrestling fan. So let me start out by asking, how many people here have ever watched a professional wrestling match? Okay, good. A pretty fair number of people. Okay, I don't ask if people are fans of professional wrestling, because I know that's an uncomfortable question to answer. Because if the answer is yes, you're probably a little embarrassed about it. I often feel that way, especially in new settings, until I kind of feel a little bit more confident or feel I've proven myself in some way. But I'm not here for 10 years, so what the heck, I'll talk about it here with all of you. With wrestling, I was kind of immersed in this world as a child. It's something that I really became kind of invested in when I was young and kind of carried on through my life. And so for me, I think part of that is that I grew up in an era that was kind of tailor-made to be a wrestling fan. Does anyone recognize this guy here? His physique is a lot like mine, right? So Hulk Hogan, yeah, was kind of this iconic hero of wrestling in the 1980s into the early 1990s. And I was a kid when he was kind of at his peak. So it kind of invited me to be a fully invested fan, to collect the action figures, to buy the t-shirts, or my parents buy the t-shirts, more to the point. But in any event, it really welcomed me kind of into that world. And then as I progressed into my teenage years, there was this shift in kind of professional wrestling culture where it moved on to what was called the Attitude Era. So in that era, things were a little bit more kind of violent, a little bit more cutting edge. There was foul language used. Women were a little bit more kind of objectified during that era. There were a lot of parts that are not so great. But as a teenage boy, this was a pretty cool era to grow up in. And this guy, Stone Cold Steve Austin, was sort of the flag bearer for that period. He's shown there beating up Mick Foley. So in that era, that kind of was fitting for my teenage years, kind of feeling a little bit more rebellious, kind of looking to kind of reject kind of old standards and whatnot. But then there was another shift in wrestling culture. I'm obviously kind of moving pretty quickly through the history of the business. There's a lot of points in between. But there's what's called the reality era. So with the reality era, it's this era where it's accepted that wrestling is not actually real, that these people are not actually fighting one another, that we understand that this is all part of a show. So with that, when I was growing up, I had the experience, and I think a lot of people in my life who identify as wrestling fans have had this experience, where people are really invested in you knowing that it's not real. Because they worry that developmentally you're going to be stunted in some way, or you just cannot pass as a functioning adult in society if you believe that wrestling is real. And of course, I recognize that it is not real. I think it's hard to be a remotely intelligent kind of adult watching it and not kind of pick up on that after at least a little while. But with that, there's a quote by one of my favorite wrestlers, Bret Hart. He said something along the lines of basically, there's something beautiful about these big, strong athletes pretending to hurt each other to entertain people rather than actually hurting each other, right, in ways that may or may not end up entertaining us. So that always kind of stuck to me. So this reality era, even the big wrestling companies, so World Wrestling Entertainment, WWE, openly acknowledges that this is a show. They release their own documentaries and podcasts and tell-all books where they're not trying to keep the secret anymore. So the star of that era is this gentleman here. Does anyone recognize this guy? Okay, so people know who John Cena is. Okay. So John Cena had kind of the fascinating place, at least to me it's fascinating, in wrestling history, of being a guy who came of age, who became a real star during this reality era, when people were openly accepting it was not real. And with that, he was the first star to kind of come of age as the flag bearer, kind of the face of wrestling, during an era when the internet was fully in full flux. Okay, so at that point, people were talking on message boards, talking on Facebook, Twitter came along, and openly criticizing this guy. Basically, because he wasn't as cool as Steve Austin, because he was a little more family-friendly, a lot of people were not as big fans of him. So he came as kind of polarizing figure. Typically, kids love him. Adults are not so keen on him, is the usual demographic breakdown on that. But becomes kind of an interesting figure for those purposes. And he's followed by this gentleman here, Roman Reigns, who's kind of the guy who is succeeding John Cena now and is facing a lot of similar flack. He is not very popular among kind of the hardcore serious audience. There are consistent efforts, though, to kind of make him the star of the show. So this is where this conversation for me turns to postmodernism and pro wrestling. And I think with that, it's important to kind of define our terms here. So for postmodernism, I'm sure that there are probably people in the room who can define these terms better than I can. I turned to the old Encyclopedia Britannica for my functioning definition for this presentation. But the idea of it being a late 20th century movement characterized by broad skepticism, subjectivism, or relativism, a general suspicion of reason, and an acute sensitivity to the role of ideology in asserting and maintaining political and economic power. That's a mouthful. So basically, where I apply this to wrestling is kind of this idea of we're going to be skeptical of what's happening. So it's not that we're going to watch TV and we're going to assume, well, Hulk Hogan is the best fighter, therefore he is the world champion. Right now we are going to say in this era, this is someone who, for whatever combination of purposes, someone in management has chosen to be our champion, chosen to be our representative, and not everyone may agree on that person being positioned in that place. So to make sure I'm not skipping way ahead, if there are people who are just completely, what on earth is this guy talking about? Why is he showing bare-chested men on the screen here? Just to define pro wrestling here quickly for us. So according to Oxford Dictionary, it's a type of entertainment involving wrestling matches whose progress and outcome are planned in advance, typically between performers with established character roles. So again, it's kind of this ongoing mythology of kind of characters telling stories, using wrestling matches as kind of a forum for telling those stories. Okay, so I'm going to show us a quick video clip here. I bet those of you who are here for extra credit didn't think you'd get to watch some wrestling in the auditorium, but you are in luck today. So I'll set the scene here as what we're going to see. So these are two fairly famous wrestlers of their era, The Undertaker and Mankind, otherwise known as Mick Foley. So they're fighting in what's called a Hell in a Cell match, basically a giant steel cage. Through various contrivances, they've made their way to the top of this structure. What we're about to see is fairly violent for folks who don't have much of a stomach for that. Feel free to look away if you're so inclined. But here we go. Okay. So The Undertaker has just thrown Mick Foley off the top of this structure through an announce table at ringside. This is actually the first of two falls from this match. About 10 minutes later, they would actually find their way back to the top of the cage. And in a move that they have both claimed was actually not planned, was actually an accident, though there's many people who are skeptical about it. The Undertaker slammed Mick Foley, and he fell through the roof of the cage to the ring below, which would probably kill a normal man. Mick Foley kept on wrestling. So we'll pick up here. Let's see, from current slide. Okay, so with all that, I want to transition into my creative work. And just to kind of just set the scene here, so for a long time, I felt pretty closeted as a wrestling fan, right? I knew there were some stigmas attached to it. I was trying to make my way through academia and be taken seriously as a writer. I kind of wanted to push this part of my interest kind of to the background. And just this is what I will, you know, privately browse on the internet, but I won't go, you know, talking about it for a wide audience. I discovered when I started writing into my interest, it opened a lot of creative opportunities for me, in part because it hasn't been very thoroughly probed by other creative writers, and in part just because it was fun for me. And I always tell my students, don't make writing hard on yourself. If you have the opportunity, try to make it something that you actually find to be fun, something that's interesting for you. So I'm going to be reading a prose poem that was kind of inspired by what we just saw there, Mick Foley kind of being thrown off the Hell in a Cell structure. When I say prose poem, so typically when we see poems, we think of these finite lines, we might think of them rhyming with each other. The idea with prose poetry is kind of, it does away with kind of that single kind of line break structure, and more with the idea that a single line of poetry might take multiple lines to communicate. So it's one cohesive idea, but it might appear in paragraph form on the page. So this is a short prose poem called The Fall. So there's just a few lines of it up here on the screen. But I'll go ahead and read it to you here. The Falls. The Undertaker threw Mick Foley off the top of a steel cage. Play-by-play man Jim Ross, purportedly unwarned about the stunt, broke character and screamed, "They've killed him." They, not the Undertaker, but management, callous and reckless enough to subject human bodies to this level of punishment, choreographed or not. But Foley wasn't dead. Wrestling had taught me all manner of things. Hulk Hogan body slamming Andre the Giant, that I might find strength. The Macho Man's top rope elbow drop, that I might fly. But Foley's crash, in that moment, I learned that I might fall. For Foley, after crashing and after being loaded onto the gurney, fought to his feet and scaled the cage again, traded blows again, fought until he was slammed through the roof of the cage to the ring below. Two great falls. And still fully fought, half-conscious, a molar lodged in his nostril. It took a choke slam and a pile driver onto a mat littered with thumbtacks to incapacitate him once and for all, for him to accept defeat. Still, nearly 20 years gone by, this memory lives on in wrestling lore, no less prominent than any Hulk Hogan slam, than the time when Bruno Sammartino reigned as world champion for 8 years straight. For it is not in falling that he, that we, that all of mankind fails. It is in falling that we might rise. Okay, so that was a poem I wrote when I was enrolled in my MFA program. Ended up being published with a magazine called Word Riot, along with a couple other wrestling-related poems. And this was kind of a collection of a series of these I wrote around that time. They're now collected in my chapbook. But I've been more recently been working on this other set of poems. So most of the poems in that series were all pretty contained to specific wrestlers and specific kind of themes I felt that they represented. I want to deal kind of more with wrestlers in the abstract for this more recent set of poems that I'm still kind of fine-tuning at this point and planning to send out soon. So this next one, I've actually got the full text of it on the page here for you all to see. It's called The Roid Rage Wrestler. Excuse my yelling a little bit for this one, but it kind of demands it. The Roid Rage Wrestler has no time for your small-minded ideals, only bench presses and Hindu squats and late-night steak and eggs by the diner's flickering light, and the fight. The shoulder tackle, clothesline, gorilla press slam, and the fight. The beer bottle crushing to forehead, slam him on the table, face crushing, and the fight. The night she told him she didn't feel safe anymore. The taillights and that face, small as the palm of his hand, and pressed the rear windshield, disappearing by degrees. Okay, so Here, what I'm playing with, most of the poem speak for itself, but I'm kind of playing with the idea of kind of the archetype of the roid rage wrestler, right? So this wrestler kind of stereotype that is all jacked up on steroids and super angry about it, right? And so kind of trying to depict kind of parts of his life, capturing these kind of finite memories throughout this poem. So the next one here is called The Legacy Wrestler. His father told him that first time in the ring to stop pulling punches and stomping his foot to make more noise when he took a shot because that was low-rent carny crap. He told me, you've really got to lay your stuff in. Twitter user Z Wrestling Expert told him in under 140 characters that he was making a mockery of his daddy's name. The old timer in the locker room, the one who came up with his old man, just 5 years his junior, just a little wrestling left in his tank, said, you should stop looking at your phone and start listening to your elders. His elders said, quit that high spot stuff. Work on your psychology. His psychologist asks, why do you put yourself through this? And is it worth it? Wife number two, mother of child number three, asks when he was sending another check, said, I don't want to get the authorities involved, though he could hear the curl in her lower lip, because the only thing that woman liked more than money in her hands was knowing somewhere in the world she was making him squirm. Kid number three asks, when can I live with you? That last time on the phone, reminding him of a promise he made, even younger, even stupider. And kid number one tracked him down the last time they toured his way, met him in the gravel parking lot of a bar called Deadbeats, and introduced himself, and the legacy wrestler thought he'd get shot, or at least socked in the mouth. No point in fighting back. He deserved it. Besides, the kid couldn't have weighed $1.50 soaking wet. But kid number one wasn't angry. He said, I'm looking to get into the family business. The legacy wrestler asked how old he was, never acknowledged he shouldn't have had to ask. Old enough. And so it was the legacy wrestler issued his first piece of advice about wrestling worth a damn. So it was he did his son his first true kindness. He told him, stay home. Okay. So those are some prose poems. So I'm going to switch gears a little bit now. So this was billed as a collection of creative work, in part because I'm indecisive and couldn't decide if I wanted to focus on poetry or fiction or nonfiction. So I thought I'll just do a little bit of each of them. So I'm going to switch gears now a little bit to a fiction piece. So this is a short story that's also kind of a work in progress at this point, called Brother, that I'm just going to read a little segment of. The story operates on the premise that there's a boy, his father is out of the picture. There are some implications that he has some mental impairments going on. He's a wrestling fan. And his mom ultimately tells him Hulk Hogan is his brother. And he says every time that Hulk Hogan says brother, that he's actually referring to him. He's talking to him through the TV. And so the story starts in the 1980s and kind of follows through to more or less contemporary times. So I'm going to read just kind of that last little passage from it. That kind of brings us all the way to just the last couple years here. So this is a piece from Brother. I didn't think about Hulk for years, even after he turned good and bad and good again. In between all of those runs, he took time off, months, sometimes years. But he never once visited us. And I had my suspicions that even if saying brother might have started out as a way of remembering me, it had devolved into a vocal tic. He probably didn't think of me as family, so I did my best to stop thinking of him that way. Then there was a scandal. Hulk had had his problems before. The steroid trial, the divorce, the sex tape. None of it stuck until someone released an old tape of him using the N-word over and over again. The WWF, now WWE, released him from his part-time contract. They scrubbed his name from the Hall of Fame webpage. The media tore him apart. His restaurant in Florida went out of business. For the first time since 1996, that's when Hulk Hogan turned bad, by the way, I felt bad for him. I suppose I never had much, just Mom, but if I ever lost her, I'd be ruined. When I tried to imagine it, I was too sad, and I had to stop myself. Hulk gave up Mom to take the world. World championships, fans everywhere, movies, two different TV shows. And now all of that was gone. And when I tried to imagine how he felt, I got sad all over again. I didn't know how to reach Hulk. I'd given up on Mom for that. So I signed up for Twitter, found his account, and wrote him that way. I had to write it once, delete it, try again, chop down, cut out words, cut out sentences, get to 140 characters. I scrapped it and tried again, simple and to the point. At Hulk Hogan, you are still my brother, and I still love you. An hour later, he replied, thank you. Only love, brother. HH. Hashtag forgiveness. Hashtag peace. Hashtag love. It was the first time we communicated man to man, no TV screen in between. It was the first time we said that we loved each other. So I unpacked the crate. I smoothed out the poster as best I could and blue-tacked it back up on my wall. I stood up his action figure on my nightstand, tried to put on the T-shirt, but it was too small, so I ripped it in two, just like my brother would have in the old days. I tied on the bandana. I forgot I had it on when I got up to brush my teeth and pee before bed. Mom saw me in the hall, smiled, and hugged me. I buried my face in her shoulder and started to cry. I tried to explain about Twitter and what Hulk said. Mom rubbed my back. She was shorter than me. She told me I was a good boy and that she loved me. Okay. So now we're going to switch gears one last time. So I'm going to switch into nonfiction gear. So I wrote this lyric essay, The Leo Burke Finish, that became the title essay for my chapbook. And it's kind of just a reflection on my life and a lot of the people in it, all told through the lens of being a wrestling fan for most of my life. So this particular passage I'm going to be reading now relates my memories of proposing to my now wife, Heather, through the lens of remembering steel cage matches from my youth. On our first date, my first visit to San Diego, Heather took me to Black's Beach, a beach across the street from UC San Diego that one can only arrive at after descending an uneven set of man-made stairs carved from a cliffside. I'd never seen a view of the ocean like the one from any point in that downward hike, much less when we reached the sand. It's a nude beach, and sure enough, a pot-bellied, white-bearded man wandered, unclothed, his penis hanging loose before him. Heather told me to look in her eyes in what I thought was a particularly romantic, tender moment before she told me that she'd made glancing eye contact with the old nudist and now wanted to ensure he'd pass by without engaging her. We progressed, knee-deep into the Pacific, where we held hands and had our first kiss. I imagined a spectacle of a proposal, even that day, even when we were so new. I'd fly out each of our closest friends and have them planted on that very beach, waiting for us. The fantasy evolved as Heather and I drew closer, as we picked our song, an acoustic recording of I Choose You by Sarah Bareilles. I'd have my friend Peek, who had played in a half dozen different bands, strum the chords and begin to sing as we reached the sand. A year and a half passed, and the more fantastical parts of this vision faded. The idea of flying out compatriots, the idea of particularly elaborate setups. We touched down in San Diego for New Year's, after a whirlwind trip through upstate New York visiting my family and friends. And when we reached the cliff overlooking Black's Beach, it was just the two of us. Not even the third-party photographer that had become so in vogue to capture the moment of the proposal. A blackbird fluttered down before us. Heather said it was a sign that something magical might happen. We began our descent. The steel cage match began as a plot device to keep either wrestler from running from a fight. Over time, the powers that be found fans more excited. Realize I didn't change my slide yet. There we go, in case anyone was wondering. Okay, over time, the powers that be found fans more excited for the great heights a cage match allowed for than the action inside the fenced walls. From a height of 15 feet, a wrestling match attains its apotheosis, the threat of one man diving onto another, the threat of a fall. And there's the descent. Contemporary steel cage matches declare the first man to escape the cage and have both feet hit the floor, the winner. And while there's a door to walk out of, it's terribly anticlimactic for someone not to climb to the other side. This often leads to a strange but oddly real-world pragmatic scenario at the end of the match. Two men have climbed over the top and hang from the far side of the cage. The first man to drop will win. But when do you stop climbing down and settle for a drop? You want to win, but you don't want to hurt yourself. Just the same, you never know when your opponent might make the decision to drop too. The question becomes what a wrestler is willing to sacrifice to win, and how soon. Thousands look on from below, awaiting the answer. Heather reached the beach first. We sat in the sand for a minute. The only other people in sight were silhouettes a football field away. No one was watching. I suggested that we walk into the water to my best approximation of where we'd had our first kiss. Then I got down on one knee. Okay, so there's more to that essay. For folks who are interested, that one is published with the Rappahannock Review. The full thing is available online. Most of these pieces are linked through my website there, MikeTChin.com. So I put that on the screen there so you can all access that. But I did want to leave. I think I probably have a couple minutes here. But for any time, if anyone had any questions, I'd be happy to take them from the room. Did I answer everything? Yes, please answer.
What about the rock?
Yeah. There's only so much time, my friend, but for sure, I think that The Rock's actually a fascinating figure because I think most people consider him secondary to Steve Austin during his prime as wrestlers, but obviously now he's gone on to probably be the biggest crossover star out of that world into kind of the rest of the world. He may well be our president in the next, you know, few years, so I don't know if that's scary. What was that? I actually do have a poem about Rey Mysterio. If anyone goes to my website, that one actually is up there too. It's about this is a smaller luchador who has a habit of he touches his mask to the heads of children who are wearing his mask in the crowd. Something I learned about him is he always whispers to them, "I can't do this alone. I need you in there with me," which I think is actually a pretty touching thing. So I sculpted another prose poem about that. I don't think it's quite as polished as some of the other ones, but it is out there in the world. But yeah, as for The Rock, I'm not sure if we're better off or worse off with him as our president than our current scenario, but I'll leave that one unfinished. But yeah, certainly an interesting figure, and yeah, probably deserves more written about him. But any other questions? Yeah, please.
Have you gone to like any main event?
So I've been to WrestleMania 3 times. The most recent time was on my honeymoon with my wife. We went to the Wizarding World of Harry Potter to make her happy, and then we went to WrestleMania 33 to make me happy. We both enjoyed both pieces of it, I like to think, but yes, indeed.
Yeah. Have you written any pieces about the crowd and how they get deeply involved and roused up or what have you?
I think that's really interesting. One thing I found in my fiction that I found to be a little bit more fruitful than actually writing about the wrestlers themselves sometimes is writing about fans, just because there is such a distinctive culture around it. There are kind of distinct sects of there are these smart fans who are the ones who kind of know all of the behind-the-scenes things and read the internet 5 times a day to catch up on the rumors and so on and so forth. I'm not one of those. And there are on the opposite end of the spectrum, there are the so-called marks, which is where we place my grandfather, who was an immigrant from China who didn't ever really learn to speak English, who just accepted it as kind of sport. He said, "There's two people fighting. I don't need to be able to speak the language to understand what is happening here." And actually, I think that's kind of what brought it into my family. I think wrestling fans are pretty fascinating. And the idea of writing about a whole crowd, I haven't really explored that very much, but I think that would definitely have some potential. So, great.
What do you think about Mrs. McMahon moving to the political world?
Mrs. McMahon moving to the political world. There is a selfish part of me that is happy for her to be involved in that world just because I am so invested in that world that bodes well for the company's long-term prosperity of WWE. This is Linda McMahon, the wife of Mr. McMahon, Vince McMahon. But in any event, her particular politics, her being in a role of kind of overseeing small businesses, I actually do find kind of problematic given she is a co-owner of a small business, but has a small business that put a lot of other small businesses out of business when they were rising to national prominence. So there's a little bit of kind of questionable kind of values there in that role. But I think it's interesting. I mean, I think it's interesting all the people we're seeing cross over into the political sphere at this point with varying degrees of kind of integrity about it and kind of merit in those roles. But yeah, she's in it now, so I guess we'll see what she does.
Wasn't that another one? Wisconsin, Minnesota, what was his name?
There was a Jesse Ventura, who was the governor of Minnesota. Yeah, he kind of broke open that sphere now. There's a wrestler, I don't know if I remember, Kane, the Undertaker's little brother. He is now transitioned in the political sphere as well. He's running for mayor of Knox County in Tennessee. So a lot of wrestlers have entered this world now, and I've heard theories about the fact that they have to kind of think on their feet and do a lot of public speaking, sometimes improvise things in response to a crowd, actually boding pretty well for that kind of career. Although the status of their minds at this point in their lives, I think, is more suspect. So.
How do you feel about them going into the movie industry?
Yeah, So the transition to the movie industry, I think, is pretty interesting. So there's this project called WWE Studios, which is under the WWE umbrella, which is widely kind of viewed as a vanity project for Vince McMahon. Basically, he created, you know, the XFL, the Alternative Professional Football League. Now he's created this movie studio with the underlying theory that he kind of wants to be known beyond the wrestling realm. He's kind of ashamed that that's the only reason that he's famous, or at least that's the read people put on it. And so wanted to create this movie studio. I think it's fine. I think the movies are what they are. They're not great cinema. But they're fine for, you know, kind of family pictures, action movies, and whatnot. I think it is interesting that people have really crossed over. Like, obviously, Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, has become a full-fledged Hollywood celebrity at this point. John Cena is sort of following his footsteps at this point and getting, you know, more traction. I think, you know, one piece of it is, I mean, they do work hard. I mean, whether you have any appreciation at all for what they do or entertained by it, it is a difficult life for, you know, a successful professional wrestler in terms of travel, in terms of, you know, maintaining their fitness, in terms of the work that they do in the ring. It's all predetermined and it's all, you know, designed not to hurt anybody, but inevitably if you fall down enough times, you are going to have those chronic aches and pains. So I think it does set them up to succeed in other places in life. So then breaking out into other pieces of, you know, the public sphere and show business, I think is sort of a natural progression there. Yeah, please, Jared.
So I was surprised by the combination of such a macho topic, and how it seems that a lot of your poetry becomes, there are very tender moments in it, right? I was just wondering if you could share something with us about your strategy in writing the poem that way, or your philosophy of what a poem should do. I don't mean it for it to be like a huge question.
Yeah.
Sure. Especially for new writers working in something like this.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in kind of any sort of public topic being a lot more interesting when we make it personal. And kind of vice versa, the most personal topics you have, finding ways of making them accessible to other people. I mean, another kind of project of series of poems I was working on was all about my late grandmother, who I was very close to. But no one wants to read a poem about your grandmother. Sorry for people who are doing that as well, but you need to kind of personalize that, make that interesting, add the nuance in there. I brought up the fact that my grandmother, despite being a very loving person to me, and someone who I cared about a lot, also had some kind of racist moments, right? And kind of how we reconcile those two things, those two identities that she's kind of juggling in that moment, or that I'm juggling for her. So similarly with wrestling, yeah, it's this world that superficially, very much full of machismo and kind of very hyper-masculine and all of these things. But these are real people, right, who are also balancing real lives. And I think that's where it gets the most interesting. While I will still sit back, and watch wrestling just on its own merits here and there, there are also just, to me, there's more interest now in kind of what is happening with them. Why were these creative choices made either by the wrestler himself or by management or whoever's writing or contributing to it? I think the interplay of those things is a lot more interesting. And so accessing those more tender kind of personal sides of people, is a lot more fruitful for kind of creative fodder. Yeah.
Great. Let's give you another round of
applause. All right, thank you all very much.
All right, so that was my lecture and reading on pro wrestling, postmodernism, poetry, and prose. Hope you all enjoyed it. Now it's time for Mike's monthly endorsement. So as an artist, I feel it's important to be consuming other things to see what interests and inspires you, and to see what's already out there and see what's come before you. So at the end of episodes, I'm recommending a book, story, movie, TV show, a band, a professional wrestling match, etc., that may have escaped a huge mainstream audience, or they might be a little bit dated now and at the cusp of being forgotten, but that I nonetheless recommend to you. So for this month, I'll be talking about The Black Tapes. The Black Tapes is a podcast that follows radio journalist Alex Regan as she works with Dr. Richard Strand. Strand is a skeptic who's doing all he can to disprove claims of the supernatural, and The Black Tapes are a collection of those cases that he can't debunk yet. So early in the show, there's a real focus on these cases as standalone episodes. So each tape is an episode and looking into them individually. And before too long, the show does take a turn and becomes more of a serialized, continuous story. I don't want to spoil anything because I think it's a really good show, and it's really easy to spoil some of the surprises in it, not just in terms of content, but in terms of the structure of the show, which kind of goes hand in hand with the content. So, you know, as always with the monthly endorsement, I'm anticipating that's something that you might check out, so and may not have heard of yet, so I'm not going to, you know, provide spoilers for that. And so, one last thing I'll mention about this, other podcast that really interests me is that, I actually thought that this podcast, was real. I thought the story it was telling was true, that it was reported like, many other podcasts, for probably longer than I should have. So I'd gotten a few episodes in and, was pretty actually, you know, frightened by what I was hearing and assuming that it was all true, and then came upon an article discussing it as fiction and realized pretty quickly that, oh yeah, this actually isn't real. And, you know, fortunately for my own dignity, that was just a little bit before things really went off the rails to the point where you'd really stretch our disbelief and be harder to believe this thing was actually true. But nonetheless, was sort of an interesting listening experience for me. I actually have a blog post that'll be coming up in the not too distant future about my experience listening to the show and thinking it was real versus my experience after I realized that it was fiction and how that impacted it, and what that can kind of say about the nature of nonfiction versus fiction. So I think all of that, is pretty interesting. And again, this podcast, The Black Tapes, I think is definitely worth a listen, especially for those of you who are interested in horror. There are definitely some scary elements of it, so if you're, you know, spooked by that sort of thing, then it might not be your cup of tea. All right, so as always, I want to thank you all for listening, and I want to thank Mike Peek for our theme music. I'm wishing you all good health, happiness, and creativity, and I'll catch you next time.